All right, welcome everybody to Lecture 5 in this American History course for the junior and senior high class with History at Our House. We are continuing with our first major theme of the year as we prepare to embark on American history and go out into an ocean of historical information. And hopefully not go out into that ocean and drown there. And I say that because I'm going to try to introduce a little bit of a metaphor into our thinking here today. As I've already begun to do, that has to do with this idea of an ocean and how to navigate an ocean, and that history is like an ocean. So that's kind of going to be what today's class feels like a little bit here. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about what it's like to go out and study history. And hopefully this will be kind of revealing for you as a young, still new student of history who's had only a limited set of experiences when it comes to studying the past. And those experiences will have consisted of a range. Some of them might have been okay. Some of them might have been really nice. Some of them probably were really boring, and there's a whole probable range that you've experienced, and I want to explain that a little bit to you. I want you to become comfortable with this, and I want you to understand it, and I also want you to understand, before we embark on it, how differently it is that we are going to be proceeding in History at Our House, that we are indeed going to be exploring the ocean that is the past in a way that other people do not do, and that is not an exaggeration. And so we're going to, I think it's important for you to know that and hopefully appreciate it as you get into doing it and to strive to do it as much as you can as well, because I think it's very important. So typically, when people learn about history, you're in this position, and everybody in your family and everybody who's ever received a modern education has been in this position. They start off where they are. You're starting off where you are today, wherever you happen to be, wherever you happen to be from, and you start to be exposed to this thing called history. And it's really crucial that you get yourself straight about what you are doing as soon as you can in this endeavor, in this project, because it is almost without exception going to be the case that if you want to study the history of anything, such as the history of America or any subject, that you will end up diving into a vast ocean of information and become stranded there. And that this will have a deep impact on how you feel about history. Most people who start to learn about history have not too different range of experiences when it comes to learning it. If they start to learn about history in certain little books that are kind of fun, enjoyable, well-written, the journey of going out into that ocean of information can sometimes be pleasant. And so they find, okay, it's kind of nice to learn this or that. Oh, isn't that story about Queen Elizabeth cool? Isn't that story about Magellan or Copernicus, or what, you pick the person that you may already feel a certain identification with, or you kind of admire them or like them. Everybody's got their own choices here. I had a student in eighth grade, kind of around your age, who was already obsessed with Napoleon by the time I had taught him any history class. And so everybody that encounters history can kind of find people in stories in the past that are kind of interesting. And that can be enjoyable. But what you end up doing there is you kind of end up thinking of history as something kind of like literature. It's a world full of stories that are enjoyable. And it's okay to kind of get lost in those stories because Well, that's what it's like to read a novel. That's what it's like to go to a movie, right? To experience a literary work of art. Movies are that, and books are that, right? Novels are those kinds of things. It's like you're carried away into another world. And that's fine for literature, for fiction, where the author is creating a universe and you're leaving yours and you're going into his, or, right? So that's what fiction is like. The problem with that perspective on history is it just kind of consists of these enjoyable stories, is that history is not fiction. And if you depart the world that you're living in and go and immerse yourself and swim around in a whole other entire world, it's very easy to get lost there. And to not really ever come back and figure out anything that has to do with the world around you. And that is not true to what history is. History is not literature. History is not fiction. History is supposed to be a subject that tells us about the world that we live in. It's not supposed to be about another world. It's supposed to be about the world that we live in. When the Greeks invented it, as we talked about yesterday, Herodotus in particular, that's what he said. He said, the reason why I'm going to undertake these inquiries, the reason why I'm going to study history and present history to you all, my fellow Greeks, is because we need to know how this world we live in came to be the way that it is. That's what he announced right at the beginning of his famous histories. And other Greek historians strove to do the same thing. But it was very difficult to stay true to that premise over time. And historians nowadays have completely drifted over into another way of doing it. They have completely drifted into another way of looking at history, which is a lot like looking at history as if it were literature. They dive into the past and they live there and they stay there. And then regular people encounter history and they say, well, sometimes that can be fun. So some people will, you know, in the world around you, and then your parents might be like this, you can kind of gauge where you are and in your family and the people around you, which category do they belong to? Some people have, you know, bookshelves in their houses. And if they do, I mean, some families don't, and that's just sad, but let's assume that there are some books in your house, and maybe some of them are history books. And so maybe what's happened is your parents every once in a while dabble in reading a history book here or then, and they kind of enjoy it a little bit, kind of like fiction. And then when they're done with that particular interesting story about some ancient Chinese emperor, then they put it back on the wall, and you know, that's it. They put it away. And then some people become history buffs. You might know somebody like that. Somebody who is an expert in a particular subject. And they have an entire bookshelf full of books on that particular subject. So in America, you'll get people, for instance, that have entire bookshelves full of material on the Civil War. So you might know somebody like that. Somebody who has a Civil War uniform. Somebody who goes and does reenactments and goes to Renaissance fairs and does all that kind of stuff. And then, once they've done that deep dive into the past, then they have to come back to real life. And they go off to their jobs. And again, they're back in the real world. So most people just kind of flirt with history a little bit. They read a little bit, and then they go back to making money and having their real lives, and what they learned in history doesn't really affect them. Some people are buffs, and they kind of make a really big deal out of it, and they learn more about the past, but then, after they're done with their deep dive, they come back to the real world. And then you've got historians. And what they do is they realize, well, hey, there's this world out there, especially in the universities, where you can get paid to become more knowledgeable about something in the past than anybody else in the world. And somebody will actually pay you a salary, and you can lecture in a place called a university, and people will respect you for knowing more about certain things in the past than anybody else. And yet again, none of it connects to the real world. The books that those people write, when they publish them, a normal person walks up to one of those books and starts reading, and within a few paragraphs has already lost patience because it doesn't really have anything to do with life as we know it. And so, what is this thing called history? Why does it always seem to be completely divorced from our lives? And most people do think that it is. And they just kind of, all right, the response to it is kind of along this spectrum that I just described. Some people fiddle with it a bit and then come back to their real lives. Some people dive in deep and become buffs, and then they come back to their real lives. And some people become professional historians, and they try to live there as much as they can. And then they come back to the real world, too. And so, but the whole way that it tends to work is that there's this ocean of information out there, and everybody is really uncomfortable in it because it just seems to be completely separate from our real lives here back on land, back in the real world, back where we have got to take care of our cars, where we have got to pay the mortgage, where we have got to, you know, try to go on vacation every now and then, and we got to get pay our healthcare bills, and we got to do all these real present day difficult things that your parents are struggling with and I'm struggling with. And what is that? What does that ocean of historical information have to do with it? Well, most people, because of the way history is done, are quite convinced that it really doesn't have anything to do with it. Or that it might, but basically it's really impossible to figure out what the connections are. Everybody was going to kind of find a connection here or there, and we'll just, you know, it'll be this bauble where we kind of play with it. It's a plaything. It's, oh, every once in a while you see a connection. Oh, how nice. It's just kind of cute. Oh, and every once in a while there's a guy that you meet that really knows a lot about this or that, and he'll talk your ear off about that particular subject, and you'll get bored with it pretty soon, and it's back to real life again. And, right, so again, but the connection's not real. The past is separate. The world we live in is a different place. And what's the point? What's the point? Doesn't seem to connect up. So today, I want to introduce you to a method that I'm developing to help us stay connected, to help us avoid falling into this trap, because I do think it's a trap. It doesn't matter how many people are in it. It can be the entire planet, and it can still be a trap. So I do think it's a trap, this notion that there is the past and there is the present and they are separate things, and you kind of have to choose to be in one or the other. And that history is about leaving this world that we live in and going and living in another one temporarily and then coming back to this real one, and really they're not connected. I think that that's a trap. And I think that the choice that most people make to ignore the past and live their lives ignoring it is not a valid choice. It is a choice that does not help you to actually understand the world that you live in. And so part of what we are up to at this early part of the class is to get you to go out and look more closely at the world and start to feel maybe a little uncomfortable about it. I think that that's completely legitimate. I hope you're feeling a little uncomfortable about it, given your homework assignment from yesterday. And looking at how complex it is, and looking at how things are all closely related and related to each other in so many different and multiple and complex ways, right? So what's our keyword there? Number one keyword concerning the modern world that we were focused on yesterday, a world of multiple and complex connectivity. Juliet, please.
The world is interconnected.
Interconnected, right? Involving extra layers of betweenness, right? We were joking the other day about how interconnected is a repetitive kind of an idea. It means between. Involving extra layers of betweenness. Not just connected, but interconnected. Where everything touches everything else in many, many different ways. Where you have traveled to different places in the world. Where you have family in different places in the world, where you consume and use things from every other country on the planet. And where, well, we continue to talk about things. But there's, like, we saw the Facebook map of the world, right? Where everybody has these communication connections to other people in the rest of the world. We saw the 24-hour transportation map of the world, where everybody's moving all the time. We saw the migration map of the world, where people are being born in one place and then they're leaving and they're going to live in another place. Everything about our world is interconnected on a global scale. So this is one heck of a difficult world to understand. And to not try to understand it is not an option. That is definitely not something that the world is going to let you do. You cannot say to yourself, the world is too complicated, so I'm just going to go live on the farm. I'm just going to go live in my village. I'm just going to go live in some place in the mountains. It's not an option. Because you go and you try to ignore the rest of the world. The rest of the world is going to come looking for you. And it is there. There's no way for us to be not connected to everybody else. So we really only have one choice. If we want to be like Aristotle, as we were talking about in lecture one, we've got to learn. We've got to go and take it seriously. And apply ourselves and figure out what this world is that we are in. And it's a heck of a job to do that. You are going to work at it at least until you graduate from high school. And in a sense, if you're doing it right, you're probably going to do it for the rest of your life, because the world's going to keep on evolving around you and you're going to have to contend with it all the time. And you're going to have to get comfortable with it. It's a big world. It's a complex and interconnected world. And here's America, and here's you in America, and wow, you've got a job to do to live in this place and do it well. Not just, to have this world unfold around you and you kind of buffeted or by it and totally out of control and totally not knowing what's going on or understanding it. That is definitely not a happy option. You can do it, but it's definitely not a happy option. It's going to be one in which you're going to experience a lot of things that are so completely beyond your understanding that it's going to be very frustrating and very difficult to do that. So you're far better off looking at the world and trying to figure it out and being guided in that effort by somebody who has some pretty decent answers to give and give you a little bit of assistance in understanding it better. And in particular, in asking certain questions that can only be answered by history, which will give you insight into the world that no other subject can offer. So, after all that long-winded spiel here about diving into this particular way of studying history, I want to show you a map that we didn't get to last time. Which I'm going to have to show you only the end result of it, because we don't have time for the big lead up into it, but it's going to work. So let me share my desktop, show you a map, fascinating map of this interconnected world that we live in. So take a moment to take this in here. I'll guide you in understanding what this map says. Okay. So what this map says is, as you see in the label that the little what's that called? the key, the map key that I provided, it says countries with official European languages, and then the colors indicate what is the main European language that is an official language in that culture. Okay? And I want to embark on this particular theme by just reminding you of something that's altogether plain and taken completely for granted by everybody that lives in America. And that is the simple, comfortable fact that we're speaking English. And most people don't give that much thought, right? Except if you live in the Southwest or if you live in Texas like me and you want to speak to a pretty sizable amount of the population, guess what problem you're going to have? along this area, you know, Texas to California, Arizona, all that. What problem are you going to have if you walk up to a random person on the street and you're going to try to speak to them, Alexander?
A lot of people speak Spanish.
And don't speak English, yeah. So both, right? Speak Spanish and English. Oh, okay, so that's nothing to be taken for granted if you are living in this particular part of the United States. And so it's kind of... It's not such a simple fact in some cases. And for some people, it's kind of controversial that there are a fair number of people who come to the United States and they don't learn English. And then that can be quite annoying and difficult for the rest of us. And so anyway, but we won't get into that particular problem here. But the fact of English is kind of generally taken for granted for the most part, right? But there is something curious about it, which is English means... from England, right? The language that we're speaking, and that's the official language of the United States, is not American per se. It's English. And it came to the United States from England. Now, in this complex and interconnected world that we live in, that's not the only place that English went. Right, that's partly what this map shows us, right? Check it out. I mean, let me do an arrow here. Where did English go? I mean, it starts here. Oopsie, I did not want that. What I wanted was... Sometimes annotations in WebEx are really annoying. I apologize. Let me just make my best effort one more time. All right, so English came across here. We know that. English went across to Canada as well. Okay. English went out to Australia. Right. English went to where else? Right. South Asia. Why do people in South Asia speak English? I mean, they also, you know, they can speak a whole bunch of other things. Why do people in Kenya speak English? Why do people in Guyana speak English? Okay, so this is just a little bit of a lead-up question, right? It's not just English. It's not just English that we're talking about here. We're talking about, if you look on this map, English is just one of four major European languages that is spoken on multiple continents. Multiple continents. You can speak Portuguese in Europe, you can speak it in the Americas, and you can speak it in Africa. You can speak French, you can speak Spanish, you can speak English, and multiple continents in the world. Why is that? How did we become kind of linguistically linked like this? How did this come to be? That's the kind of question that we ask using history. We look at the world that we're in. We look at this complexity and this spectrum of mysteries and questions and challenges and problems, right? You're going to be looking, as part of your homework, you're looking at the news. And the news is full of references to places like Ukraine, Somalia, Libya. I mean, what is up with that? Where are the? How come these places are invading our attention? Why are we paying attention to things that are going on all the way over there? This interconnection that we have in the world is partly responsible for that. And so this is this complex world that we're in. And what we do with history is we ask questions about it. And seek the answers where they are. They're not here right now. They're in the past. So we can better understand our world by seeking answers in the past. Now, this is not easy. It's not easy at all because for the reason that I stated earlier, which is that the past is a gigantic ocean of information. Gigantic. It's 5,000 years worth of recorded information for multiple civilizations. And so it's some of you will remember the word that I like to use to describe this particular problem. Right? Timothy, what is the name for, how do we name this problem of this vast overabundance of information? What is it?
A plethora?
It's a plethora. The past is a plethora. Plethora is a great word. It means too much. That's all. It just means there's way too much stuff. You could not learn the past as such, the whole thing. If you tried and you sat down and you didn't sleep for the rest of your life, you couldn't learn it. There's too much. If we're talking about just collecting all the information and dumping it into your brain, it's just not possible to do it. It's a plethora. So when we approach the past, we have to be really careful about doing that, because it's very easy for us to go out into the past, and now I'm going to start to try to deploy this metaphor, and get completely lost out there. To go out into that ocean of information. The ocean is a kind of plethora too, right? I mean, you go swimming in the ocean, you'll find out it's a plethora pretty quickly, unless you can get back to shore. So that's the metaphor here. We're going to go out into this ocean of information, and we don't want to drown. We don't want to get stuck there. We can't live in the ocean. We're not fish. So we do want to go out into the ocean that is history, because it's going to be a really amazing place that shows us a lot about the place where we live, but we got to be careful not to get stranded there. We don't want to become, you know, we don't want to go and live on a desert island in the middle of the ocean. We don't want to get stuck floating around on the ocean. We want to come back to where we are, the place that we live, the world that we live in our specific personal context, and live there, right? After having gone out into the past, to learn something about where we live, so that when we get back here, oh, we know more about it. We understand it better. We're more capable of living in this place. We don't feel overwhelmed by all the information that we're getting on the news website. We can parse through it. We can sort through it. We're good at it. Okay, that part's important, that part's not, and so on and so forth, right? We know how to navigate through a complex, interconnected world. Okay. So, to take the metaphor of the ocean, how do you go out and explore an ocean? Okay, let's see if I can pull off this metaphor. I'm not very experienced at this particular storytelling narrative here, so I'm going to do my best to carry you along, and hopefully you'll be able to see the parallel. I don't think it's that contrived, but you'll have to tell me whether it works for you or not. Even though I know students of your age are not prone to being very expressive about that, I'll pull it out of you. So you'll have to tell me whether or not it works for you or not, this metaphor. Okay, but basically, the metaphor is this. So if we think of ourselves as being where we are in this place of comfort, in this, in our homes, in our home cities, in our home states, wherever we happen to be. And that is that comfort zone that we are in. If we're going to kind of apply a metaphor to that and say, well, if we're going to strike out into the ocean, that home base of ours, that safe place, is like a dock for anybody that's got a ship that's going to be going out into the ocean. Right, so as you're preparing to go out into the ocean in your life, into the ocean of knowledge out there, right, you start off in this comfortable place. This safe place that's tied to land, that is your home base. Everything's very stable, right? This is your local spot where you're used to being, and you're in the dock, and that's your comfort zone. So And then what do? Well, before you go out into the ocean, you've got to make sure that you understand and that you are familiar with the place around the dock, which is the harbor. Right? Here's this is a picture taken from a boat, right? Can you see the churning water over here? And this ship used to be right there in the dock, And these people are on the boat, right? And they're moving out into the harbor, and they're looking back, and what a cool place, right? And this is a harbor, and then this is still very safe, right? This is where you know the different spots, and you know how to navigate around this before you go out into the open ocean. You need to be able to navigate this place before you go out into the ocean, right? If you don't know how to navigate the harbor before you go out into the ocean, well, you wouldn't think that it happens too much, right? But it's not that it doesn't happen. Most people are pretty, you know, in the metaphor, right, of life, they kind of are pretty adept at dealing with the harbor, right? The harbor is the world around us. If you don't get to know the world around you, if you don't get to know the United States, the different parts of it, the political parties, presidents and all that, and the things that are going on around you, and so on, right? Then, well, you're going to crash in the harbor itself, and that's really not going to be much. You're not even really going to be ready to go out into the ocean out there. But there's this closer kind of place in our world that is this world that we live in that's more comfortable to us, but yet still a little treacherous, and we shouldn't take it for granted. That's the harbor that we are in, and we need to know as much as we can about it before we go out into the ocean. If we don't, we end up like this, right? If we are successful, though, we end up out and starting to move out into the bay and out into the ocean, right? And before long, we are quite far away from the city. We are quite far away from our home base. Whatever, right? We're almost out in the open ocean, aren't we? We're pretty far. Now, if we don't know how to sail, and we don't know yet how to use navigational computers and all that kind of stuff, we don't necessarily have to, right? As we're going out and learning more and more information, what we need before we go out further into this ocean is we need to know places like this. What is this sort of thing here that's pictured here? Ever encountered one of those out in the sea or, you know, in any similar context? Ask them, what is that? Let me unmute you, please. Go ahead, Ashton. All right. Somehow your setup's not very good. Alexander, go ahead.
A buoy.
It's a buoy. Okay.
It
so like what?
It tells you where to go or where not to go. Because I went kayaking a little bit, and there were buoys on the entrance to the bay telling you where there were no rocks.
Well, there you go, right? So it's a navigational marker. It tells you, all right, where you are located. You don't have to have a map. You don't have to have any other particular thing. It gives you a lot of important information. Without you necessarily being an expert, you can get around quite a bit just with this information. Just by being able to visually see the buoy, it tells you a lot. Okay, now, here's a crucial feature of a buoy like this, right? Does this thing float around in the water and go all over the place? What is really important about this type of little tool out there in the world? Sky, please.
It's anchored to the floor so it doesn't float all around.
Okay, right, so why is that important in this particular story here of how you're trying to get around? Why does that matter so much?
Because we need a steady place where we can get our footing before we go out into the ocean.
Okay, right. So our metaphors are getting a little mixed here, but good one, Sky. Right? Footing, maybe not the right word, but you get the idea, right? We need to get, how about on the ocean, we call it our bearings, right? Okay, so I know it's hard to keep the metaphor sometimes, right? But yeah, exactly. We need to figure out where we are before we keep going, right? Because the further out we go, we sure better be experts before we lose completely lose sight of land and before we are not able to see around us and we get lost in the ocean, right? So here we have these markers that help us to orient where we are going the further and further out we go. Okay, so This is going to be my metaphor here for learning about the past. Now put your hand down, Sky, unless you still have something. Okay, so this is going to be the metaphor that I'm going to be using with regard to this. The buoy has to be anchored, right? So an anchor is that chain that has this big, heavy hook that goes down from the buoy down to the ground, and it fixes that buoy in exactly the same location all the time, right? And ships have anchors as we go out into the sea, and we need to stop and be in one place and not just be floating around uncontrollably. We use an anchor, right? You let the anchor out. It crashes to the bottom of the sea. It becomes fixed at the bottom of the water, and it holds your ship in place. Even no matter how much of a wind and how much storm and all that. I mean, obviously, it doesn't always completely overcome all forces, but mostly it does, right? Okay, Bria, question or comment?
I was on a cruise ship recently, and I saw anchors like that, but they were huge, and I thought they didn't use anchors in cruise ships.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? They do, and that's the stunning thing. If you go to a shipyard or you go to a port, you can see, like, on aircraft carriers, on giant cruise ships, even those giant ships use anchors, and the chains that hold them are thicker than your leg, and so they are just unbelievable. Yeah, all ships use them, even the biggest ones, so it's amazing, right? So, yeah, I appreciate that comment. It can be quite fantastic to see the size of the anchors that ships use in the modern world with these huge ships that we have, so... So yeah, if you happen to have like a naval museum or something like that around you, go and check out the anchors next to the aircraft carriers or the battleships or whatever. Or if you happen to see, you know, cruise ship and you can get close enough to it, check out the size of the anchor on those things. They're huge. Right. So yeah, that's a good point. And so here's the metaphor for applying this concept of an anchor to our studies here. Our dock, when we're studying in the ocean of history, is home, right? It's the city that we live in. It's the place where we're comfortable. When we're done, that's where we come back. Okay, Ashton, keep focus, guys. No more chatting. So the dock in our story of studying history is this comfortable base that we have that's safe, right? It's our home. It's our home city. It's our home state. It might be even our home country, depending on how we feel about, you know, how big that base is. But it's more local. It's closer to it's home. All right. And then, well, then there's this larger place that we are, that in the metaphor of history versus an ocean, right? It's kind of the harbor. It's larger and it's got a whole bunch of different docks. And, well, if you're not careful, even being navigating in that place can be pretty dangerous, right? As we saw with, who was it here? There he is, right? Even the harbor can be dangerous, right? And so that's this larger world that we live in. The present day, and this large interconnected world that we live in, that you are investigating now in your news-based homework assignment, right? It's still a pretty complicated place. Never mind, in history, we're going to go out into the ocean. Bria, go ahead.
I was just thinking about it, and there's two different sections. Like, North America and South America are all the way over here. There's an ocean separating these two different places, but yet we still have contacts with all these thousands of people.
Yeah, not in thousands, billions actually. But you're right, that's an interesting observation, Bria, about the nature of the harbor we live in. There's this harbor that's the Americas. There's even this harbor that is North America in a sense, that's separate from this other spot over here and different with the English language and stuff like that. And you're right that even there, navigating those differences is kind of interesting and revealing to think about those things. And America is different and special just because of where it is, Just because it is separated from Europe by this ocean and separated from Asia by this ocean, just the harbor of the world that we live in is an interesting and complicated place. But if we're going to go out and study history, what we're going to do is we're going to go out beyond this into an ocean of information. And as we do that, we need these, not these, and sort of these, but we need something that looks like this. We need markers that can help us to stay oriented as we move further and further out into the ocean of information. We need certain kinds of facts to which we can anchor our learning, which we can go back to, and if we come back to this spot, we'll be safe because we'll be we won't be in the present, we won't be right here and now, but we'll be closer and within sight of the things that we know and the world that we know. And these are the types of facts that I call historical anchors. When we go out and study the past, if we don't want to get lost there in the ocean of information, we need to anchor our pursuit of knowledge in the present by finding facts that really help us to reconnect with the present as quickly and effectively as possible. So how do we do that? What kind of facts are they? How do they work? What are these strange facts, Mr. Powell, that you refer to as historical anchors? Well, I'm going to introduce you to one of them today and let you chew on that a little bit, try to digest that information. Wow, the metaphors are coming hard and fast here. And think about that. Let's just be plain about it. I'll let you think about it over the next few days. And then we come back on Monday with the next history lecture. Tomorrow is art, of course. And then we will expand on this notion of having and what these are, these special facts called historical anchors, and what the benefit of knowing them is. So here is the first of our historical anchors. I'm going to introduce it to you by kind of asking a question and getting you to cast off into the ocean and imagine that you're going to go find the answer to this question. Why does this map look like this? That's maybe too broad, too vague. Why, let me be more specific. Why does this world that we live in have languages that came from here everywhere else? Did you get that question? Why does the English language here, 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 and here? Why is the French language here, 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 and here? Why is the Spanish language all over here? Why is the Portuguese all over here? That's not homework. It's a real question, and I'll answer it if you can't answer it. Why is our world connected the way that it is because of language in that particular way? Declan, I'm going to get to you. Bria, go ahead.
Well, as we know, there are lots of settlers and lots of people that went across the world and brought their languages.
You are indeed right.
Why?
Okay, and can you give me an example of settlers that came to America and did that?
Spanish.
Well, okay, yes, indeed, right? So there were people that colonized and came to places like Mexico and Peru and so on. Okay, who are those famous settlers that came to America in order to escape from the religious persecution of the English kings and have their own separate religion? Anybody know the names of that group of settlers? Sky, maybe?
I'm not sure about the name of those settlers. Maybe the Pilgrims? No.
Yes, that is it. You got it right. That is right. But go ahead.
I had another comment about maybe why languages could be, like, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
During the wars, when people conquered the other people, they used to bring their languages to them, and the languages kind of stuck there.
Yeah, now we have to, the wars is a very wide idea, so we're going to have to be more careful about that. Because are you meaning things like World War I, World War II, which are global wars, or are you referring to other things? And really, the answer doesn't really lie in wars. in this particular case. More in the direction that Bria was mentioning with regard to settlers such as the Pilgrims. Bria, did you want another chance at that one?
Well, there's the Pilgrims coming to America, and then there was Columbus from Spain, and then I know there's another one that was major.
Okay, hold on. So, Bria, yeah, you're getting a few, you're grouping together people that are very, very far apart. For instance, the Pilgrims and Columbus are more than 100 years apart, so doesn't quite do to put them together. Because the Pilgrims came to settle in America, among other people. And then the question I was going to follow up with was, well, how did they even know that there was a place to settle? How did they even know there was an America that they could come to at all, and then it was possible to reach it, and how to do that? So Declan was on track here. Declan?
They had explorers.
Yeah, before the settlers were a wave of explorers. Now, in particular, of course, before anybody could come to America, what had to happen, Alexander?
Some people had to go there, including Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, not just including Christopher Columbus. It was his voyage that made the difference. As it turns out, as some of you may know, there had been other people that had been there, and there were people that had kind of settled there, and that didn't connect anybody to the world. There wasn't any connection between America and the rest of the world until something very specific happened at a very specific time. Until this person, Christopher Columbus, sailed across from Spain. As some of you know, he was sailing technically not quite Spain yet. We'll learn that. But anyway, Spain is good enough for now. And found this place that he didn't expect to be there. So it turns out he was trying to get to Asia by sailing west. And instead, he found America. So now we have this colossal change in everybody's understanding of the world because of Christopher Columbus's discovery. 1492 is the moment that everything changes. It's the moment where the Europeans begin to realize that there is this other place in the world. And it's the moment where globalization really starts to take off. There had been explorers before, and we will learn about them, but pretty much they were stuck all over here in the places that people already knew, just looking for new ways to get around the places that people already knew. They weren't really achieving all that much. And on the other hand, this whole set of continents over here was pretty much invisible to everybody. Nobody knew about them, and the people that lived on them had no idea that there were continents over here either. Everything was disconnected. Everything was separate until the voyages of Columbus starting in 1492. Once Columbus discovered America, everything changed. This is our first historical anchor. Questions or comments? Alexander?
No, I just forgot to
put that. Okay. Bria?
Me? I don't really have anything else to add.
Oh, okay. Watch out with the hands then. You guys got to get practiced in putting those down if you don't want to be called upon. All right, so this is our first historical anchor. There is nothing in American history that you cannot connect to this anchoring fact. Everything in American history can be made more intelligible and more understandable by connecting it to the voyages of Columbus, in particular the voyage of discovery of 1492. This is our first anchoring fact. So, for instance, why do people in the Americas speak Spanish, Portuguese, French, and English? Why do they speak European languages? Any answer that you can come up with must rely upon the fact that Columbus discovered America in 1492. There's no way to explain it without reference to that voyage. Sky, go ahead.
Once Columbus discovered America, everybody realized there was a new place out there, and they wanted more freedom, and they wanted something else. So all these people from all these different countries started sailing to America.
Yeah, now I wish all of them wanted freedom, but you're right, and some of them did. And some of them, so we'll learn about what they wanted, and unfortunately they weren't all nice people either, which is difficult to kind of deal with. Some of them were quite rapacious, some of them were very intolerant of others, some of them were very militaristic, there were so many different people, and they didn't get along with each other, and they didn't get along with the people that they found, so the story is awfully complicated, but you're right, Sky, that some of them wanted more freedom. Some of them had a certain idea as to how they wanted to lead their lives, and so the settlers that came had different ideas, and we're very fortunate that the ones that ended up coming to America had a certain kind of group of ideas that they all relied on and that they became clearer on, and eventually they created a new nation. So you're absolutely right. That's kind of the process. But none of that makes any sense without 1492. That's our anchor. As we go and we learn, and one of our anchors, as we go out into the past and learn about these things, we can connect what we learn in the past to the present, to our lives around us. That's our first anchor, actually. And then another thing that we do in order to make sure that everything is connected and everything comes back to where we are is we connect things to the events of 1492. And that makes them more intelligible also and more connected to what we see around us. We want to understand a world that is so full of European languages. You can't do that without understanding the voyages of Columbus. So that helps. This is the world that we live in. That's a historical fact that makes it more understandable. Okay, Bria, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking maybe because Columbus went to Spain to get support from the queen there, and it's possible that there could have been people that were sailors that were from Asia or all the different places that those languages come from.
I'm not sure about that speculation, but it's more than we can get into right now. So we are well over time, and so we are going to have to bring things to a close. But I appreciate that you're trying to kind of think about a few extra, have some interesting thoughts related to this. That's a great thing. So don't worry. We will get into the story of Isabella of Castile, who funded Columbus's voyage, what Spain was like at the time, what happened as a result when the Spanish came over, how they behaved and stuff like that, and all kinds of things. So these are all connected to how the world that we live in is the way that it is. So that is the way that we're going to do it. And 1492 is going to be one of those anchor buoys that we're going to use every time we want to go into the ocean of information. We're going to make sure that we can see that one. We're going to make sure that we can see 1492. Or if we need to go further out into the ocean, we're going to say, well, let's go find another one. Maybe we can find an island out there where if we know where that is, then we'll also be able to always have a reference point and not get lost. And then we can always make our way back to the world that we live in. And that's the thing, ultimately, that we're trying to understand. All right. So, like I said, spend some time thinking that over. See if you want to challenge me on that. See if you have questions or issues or difficulties with that. I will keep working this concept for you so that it becomes clearer. But basically what we're going to be doing here is developing these really useful facts of information at the beginning so that we can go and learn more of them well, learn more of them in a way that connects up to the world that we live in. Okay, I better bring it to a close. Thank you all, and I will talk to you tomorrow in History Through Art. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye.